religion of one people. It did not have ambitions toward larger missionary or world religion status. Taoism, a significant religion in China, a very intricate and attractive one, also didn't travel widely. The point is pretty clear. Stating that there are three major world religions and that the post-classical period is where they get their geographical shape and exert much of their influence is not a denigration of other major religious faiths or even the role these faiths played in key regional histories. It's simply a statement. These religions, in one very simple but basic respect, were somewhat different. What caused the spread of world religions? Here again, there's a potential trap because I'm not trying to downplay the role of spiritual attractiveness, the role of divine guidance. But from an historical standpoint, in addition to whatever factors one attributes there, three types of cause stand out particularly. First, remember the context. Although Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam began at very different chronological points, their takeoff period clearly has something to do with the later stages of the classical empires and then with the collapse of these empires. Several of the religions, Buddhism and Christianity most notably, would benefit from the existence of classical empires in the Mediterranean and in China, for example, that facilitated travel, that facilitated missionary activity. But they benefited probably even more from the troubles that set in as the classical empires declined. As economic levels deteriorated, as political instability grew, and don't forget, as new levels of disease and therefore death spread, looking for otherworldly solace, looking for institutions that might supplant or compensate for the decline of the institutions of the state, this was a very compelling framework within which missionary religions could take hold. The second set of factors in the spread of the world religions involves missionary qualities themselves. Missionary activity developed in all three cases pretty early and obviously quite effectively. It was often correlated. This was quite vivid in the case of Buddhism and later Islam, perhaps a little less with Christianity in the early phases. It was often correlated by expanding merchant activity as well. So merchant outreach and missionary outreach frequently went literally hand in hand, and merchants, through their commercial success as well as their geographical outreach, would help bring the religion to new areas. And missionaries, in turn, as they sought to convert new souls, would frequently set a framework within which new commercial activity could develop from the host society as well. So missionary zeal clearly established in all three cases once the decision was made to take the message to the world is a second undeniable factor, backed sometimes by commercial activity, sometimes by other kinds of institutional support as well. And the third factor, which we've already touched on with regard to links to commercial activity, the third factor involved the extent to which one or more of the world religions could seem associated with other aspects of success. Obvious case in point, individual rulers, and this happened in all three of the major world religions, individual rulers might decide, this looks like a winning religion, or this missionary successfully healed my son, and I'm going to adopt it not just for myself, but for my whole people. And in the process, I will use the religion to help cement new kinds of loyalty between my people and my rule. Or, as noted, religion might be associated with commercial success. Join the bandwagon, and it looks like you may have opportunities to trade with new sources of wealth. Political, military, commercial success often could seem to be associated with one of the new religions and persuade people to climb on board. And there's no insult to the religions attached to this final factor. So, the conditions of the late classical, early post-classical period, the energy and zeal of missionaries themselves, and the extent to which religion could be attached to political, economic, and other factors. These were clear sources of this major period in which belief systems spread to new areas. The chief change, if you look at the big picture, The chief change involved here was a replacement of what we've already seen was a pervasive attachment to polytheism, a replacement of this attachment by one of the major new religions. People stopped believing in the old sets of gods and goddesses, whether we're talking about China or the Mediterranean, and they started believing in one of the new, more unifying, more abstract religious sources, again, choosing among the three. This process of conversion, this major shift in attachments to polytheism, was, of course, attached also to compromise. All of the world religions, formally or informally, made some bargains with polytheism. They might, for example, build new religious institutions where the old temples had been, thus associating the power of the old religion with the claims of the new. They might incorporate not literally the old gods and goddesses, but some hints of them in rituals of veneration for other holy figures. They might make other adjustments, all of which go under the name of syncretism, the extent to which in accepting new beliefs, people continue to be able to find some remnants of the old. This doesn't mean that the change wasn't significant. It just means, as a matter of fact, processes of conversion are complicated and the new rarely outweighs the old entirely. Buddhism, as it fanned out from India, took two major directions, with a third noteworthy at least briefly. Interestingly, as is obvious already, Buddhism began to lose ground to Hinduism in India proper. The Gupta Empire definitely favored Hindus. Many Indian rulers saw in Hinduism a clearer support for military activity, even for commercial activity, and distrusted the abstractness and the spirituality of Buddhism. But as Buddhism faded in India, it began to gain holds elsewhere. Buddhism spread in one major direction to Southeast Asia, winning converts in Sri Lanka, in many parts of continental Southeast Asia, where Buddhism remains important to this day. This was one major path. Buddhism also spread, of course, at the end of the classical, early post-classical period. Buddhism also spread to China, and through China, to Korea and Japan. The Chinese, eager for Buddhism as the classical period drew to a close, the Chinese embraced Buddhism, though, as we have seen, on stipulation that Buddhism adapt a bit to Chinese modes of thought, particularly with regard to family life and with regard to the importance of the political and imperial order. But for many centuries, Buddhism exercised a profound influence on China, with many Chinese visitors coming to study in Buddhist institutions in India and in Southeast Asia, large numbers of converts. Buddhism would also exercise an impact on other Chinese belief systems such as Taoism, pushing toward greater spirituality, greater use of devices like ritual and magic in order to compete with Buddhism. But it's important to note that ultimately, the Chinese dynasty that commanded the first part of the post-classical period, the Tang Dynasty, ultimately turned against Buddhism on grounds that Buddhists were unreliable allies of the state, were too foreign to Chinese values, and a significant effort began to reduce official support for Buddhism and even to persecute Buddhism, although the religion retained some hold among the Chinese. But the spread of Buddhism to other parts of East Asia was less qualified and actually would exert a longer-term influence than the spread within China itself. There was also a Buddhist surge into Central Asia and, belatedly, a Buddhist surge into Tibet. Buddhism showed an impressive capacity to adapt to local conditions, to tolerate and merge with other aspects of the local religious scene, and it clearly has to be rated a great success, if not an exactly tidally unified religious package, as it spread into various parts of South, Southeast, and Eastern Asia. The story of the spread of Christianity may be a somewhat more familiar one. Christianity fanned out widely in the Roman Empire during the centuries after the death of Christ. Missionary activity was obviously central here. And remember, this spread involved not only conversions in the European parts of the empire, but also extensive penetration into Armenia, into North Africa, and into parts of the Middle East. Christianity would actually show the capacity even to pour slightly beyond the boundaries of the Roman Empire, as Christianity ultimately developed some following in Persia and even in other parts of Asia in a tract that was somewhat separate from the main institutional foci of Christianity. The decision of the Emperor Constantine early in the 4th century to tolerate Christianity represented a significant new opportunity for Christian advance within the Roman Empire. At that point, Christians probably numbered about 10% of the empire's population as a whole. They now began to gain much more rapidly, and Christianity was named a state religion at the end of that same century, a further opportunity for gain, although also a source of new problems as the boundary line between church and state became somewhat murkier. Christian expansion after the fall of Rome took mainly one of two paths. In the first place, the Byzantine Empire in Eastern Europe and the northern Middle East, the Byzantine Empire began to sponsor Orthodox missionaries who went northward into East Central and Eastern Europe. They developed, among other things, a modified Greek alphabet for the Slavic language. They penetrated widely in the Balkans and in Russia, and something of a missionary no man's land developed in parts of East Central Europe as Byzantine missionaries competed with missionaries sent out from Rome in the West. Western missionary activity also fanned out to the north, reflecting the fact that the South was increasingly closed by the success of Islam. The papacy sponsored missionary activity in Britain, Germany, and Scandinavia, as well as again pushing eastward into places like Poland. So during the post-classical period, particularly the first centuries, missionary activity that had previously been largely, though not entirely, confined to the Roman Empire, now pushed much more widely, particularly toward the north, in two major streams. The spread of Islam during the post-classical period itself was the greatest success story of all, as Islam reached larger territories and more peoples than either of the other two missionary religions, although the exact numbers are obviously impossible to determine. Islam spread rather quickly among Arabs and some others in the Middle East and North Africa. It spread widely in India, becoming India's largest minority religion by the middle of the post-classical period. It spread into Central Asia, interestingly displacing Buddhism in the process. It's one of the only cases where one of the world religions had an initial hold that was later successfully dislodged by another. Islam also, toward the end of the post-classical period, began to make major inroads in Southeast Asia, particularly beginning conversion processes in Indonesia, which is now the largest Muslim nation in the world. And Islam finally had success also in a few parts of southern Europe and in much of sub-Saharan Africa. Three different stories, three somewhat different, though not entirely distinct parts of the world, a common pattern of significant missionary activity, and a common pattern as well of successful efforts both to convert people to new patterns of belief, but also to utilize some existing remnants of older belief as an additional inducement. The most obvious point about these three world religions involves their differences. Buddhism was noticeably different from Christianity and Islam. It was not as clearly a religion of the book. It had a less clearly defined relationship to authorities in the state. It was more hostile to things of this world, although there's a strain in Christianity and Islam that could rival this. But Christianity and Islam were hardly cut from the same cloth either. They differed noticeably on the nature of the divinity. They differed on specific matters as to how salvation could be attained. They differed on the organization of the religion. They differed with regard to degrees of tolerance. So the spread of world religions calls upon an understanding that a new differentiating factor was introduced into world history in Afro-Eurasia, a differentiating factor whose ramifications obviously continue to apply to the present day. But, second theme, in addition to forging a new religious map, in addition to carving out new types of differences, the religions had some common effects that helped describe larger processes of change during the post-classical period and also beyond. For example, familiar point, but I think a really important one, the spread of world religions increasingly set the framework for artistic and philosophical activity. All of the religions, as they spread, helped define most of the leading artistic work, helped define the goals of most of the most significant architects as religious buildings began to outstrip secular buildings in expense and purpose. Artistic activity during the post-classical period, although there were some secular representations, artistic activity in much of Asia, Africa, and Europe was defined by one or more of these basic religions. And this was true even in China, despite the attacks on Buddhist influence, where Buddhism significantly colored Chinese art and architectural activity. The same obviously applies to a good bit of literature and certainly philosophy. As we will see in discussing Islam next time, religion hardly totally conquered the philosophical sphere. There was still independent scientific activity, but increasingly, much philosophical work, even if it didn't entirely slide over into outright theology, much philosophical work had to be devoted to questions about how older philosophical systems, scientific discoveries, fit with the new sense of religious truth, with the new commitment to faith. World religions, in other words, define much of the larger cultural life of the post-classical period in virtually all the civilized parts of Asia, Africa, and Europe. The same, though particularly for Islam and Christianity, the same applied to a good bit of law. Increasingly, legal systems were reshaped or were divided between secular and religious areas of activity. And the notion that law was simply a matter for the state to decide, that law was independent of a larger religious system, this attitude was increasingly jettisoned as the religions developed significant bodies of legal thought and commanded significant jurisprudence. All three of the world religions raised new questions directly for the state itself. If these religions carried primary truth, what was, in fact, the role of the state? Should the state be reshaped mainly to defend religion? Was this the new main political purpose? Was there some way to separate political and religious areas of activity? Was the relationship between religious authority and political authority one of superiority, inferiority, even though the state had the troops? These political questions, obviously very different in specific contexts, these political questions would be quite significant in all three of the world religious areas during the post-classical period and beyond. The world religions had an interesting relationship with trade. And remember, we've already argued that trade was the second, along with religion, the second shaping factor of the post-classical period as a whole. On the surface, the rise of world religions might seem to discountenance trade. After all, the main purpose of existence, according to any of these world religions, was otherworldly. Too much attachment to material objects and motivations would be bad, and all of the world religions could generate extensive criticism of merchant values and merchant activities. Christ, for example, was reported to have said, "It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to gain heaven." And there would be Islamic figures who would have rather similar thoughts about how it was very difficult for merchants to maintain a pure religious life because their motives were so inherently corrupt. So the world religions introduced a new tension, or at least exacerbated a tension, between value system and trade. But the world religions also, in their own way, as we have seen, encouraged trade in several ways. Missionaries might set up outposts to which traders could come. All the world religions, although they didn't do this entirely deliberately, established religious institutions that could serve as way stations for travelers. Buddhists, for example, had networks of inns where religious pilgrims could go as they traveled to holy sites, but where merchants could repair as well. The same thing would occur in Islam, and the same thing would occur in Europe with Christian monasteries, both Orthodox and Roman Catholic. So, inadvertently perhaps, but quite really, world religions could stimulate trade, even though they introduced this new tension. And most obviously of all, as each of these new religions posited a larger religious unity, a single God, or a single divine essence, they might encourage merchants to venture more widely than they had before, confident that their religious system would now go with them because it was a system for the whole world. The relationship with trade was important, if complicated. Each of the world religions also carried an important social message, although, again, a complicated one. On the one hand, and this is really crucial, there are a few other religions that do this, but the world religions did this quite systematically, though each in its own way. In the first place, the world religions all posited the fundamental spiritual equality of all believers. Whether you're rich or poor, slave or free, if you believe, you have the same kind of access to spiritual rewards and to the possession of a soul. This is true in Buddhism, in Islam, in Christianity. At the same time, and this may have been the price of becoming a world religion, the world religions also argued that social inequality in this world would always be with us. Poverty would always be with us. The main point of religious life was not to fight the social system, because that would distract from the true otherworldly goals. So you have this odd dilemma. On the one hand, the world religions significantly modified the casual, calm acceptance of inequality that, as we have seen, described the classical period. It was no longer glibly possible to say, well, slavery will always be with us. And indeed, the world religions might work either to reduce or to modify slavery, and that was not a trivial result. But none of the world religions crusaded against social inequality. None of them directly subscribed to the most explicit forms of social protest. So the world religions could be bent in occasional social protest to be used to argue for greater attacks on inequality, for new kinds of social justice. But equally important, this was not the main point. The same bifurcation, and equally intriguing, applies to gender. Each of the three world religions, in contrast, for example, to Hinduism, clearly specified that women had souls alongside men. And each of the world religions provided new opportunities for women in religious vocations, and in the case of Christianity and Buddhism, particularly in religious institutions. So, as with society more generally, the world religions could seem to be aligned against the most literal traditional forms of patriarchy, which argued for sharper differentiations between men and women. But although the world religions said this about women's spiritual capacity, they also, for the most part, sustained and even in some case increased the institutions of patriarchy by insisting that men were the major bearers of the religious faith, that women might be singled out because they had a greater propensity to sin. This was an aspect that could be found both in Islam and in Christianity. The impact, therefore, on actual gender relations could be quite complicated and even contrary to what the assertion of spiritual equality might stipulate. Many women were encouraged, actually, to religious devotions. This was true, for example, among Chinese Buddhists. They might be encouraged to religious devotion because this would actually distract them from concerns about other aspects of their lives in which inequality might loom large. Women's devotion to otherworldly purposes might, in a larger sense, distract them from this worldly concerns about the inequalities imposed by patriarchy. And in point of fact, during this same period that the world religion spread, new institutions developed that extended and further illustrated women's inequality. These institutions were not mainly the result of the world religions, but they coexisted with it. For example, the spread of foot binding in China, the limited but interesting practice of sati in India, which was a Hindu practice, where women were encouraged to immolate themselves on their husband's funeral pyre if they were widowed, on grounds that once your husband was dead, there was no purpose anymore in existence. This was a period in which, in fact, in many parts of the world, women's inequalities increased, even though the burden of the world religion might be superficially bent in the other direction. The social impact of the world religions was complicated, and it was not entirely played out in the post-classical period itself. The world religions had then some common effects on not just patterns of belief, but larger cultural expressions, introducing new political and social tensions, playing an interesting but on the whole probably encouraging role with regard to the expansion of trade. The world religions, as they spread in the post-classical period, raised one final point, the point in which religions, individual religious people, had to decide between hostility and tolerance. There are certainly examples, as the world religions spread, of new levels of intolerance attached to the new faiths. There were points, as we've noted already, at which Chinese authorities attacked Buddhism in new ways. There were certainly points at which other Asian religions tried to belittle the Buddhist message. Christians and Muslims clashed, obviously in the Crusades, obviously in the Christian reconquest, so-called Christian reconquest of Spain. But there are also cases in the post-classical period, as the religion spread, of surprising islands of mutual toleration. Many parts of the Middle East saw significant Christian and Jewish communities remain, even as Islam spread. Muslim Spain tolerated, even encouraged, interactions among the three basic religious faiths. The decision as to emphasis on tolerance or intolerance was not fully completed in the post-classical period, though obviously new questions were raised.
Lecture 12, The Impact of Islam.
The rise of the Arabs in Islam was clearly one of the most important developments during the post-classical period. Three major facets of this need to be emphasized. First, the surge of the Arabs from their original homeland in southern Arabia, north into the rest of the Middle East, or much of it, and also across North Africa through a process of Arab dispersion and local assimilation. This created a new civilization zone that combined the Middle East and North Africa in a package that really remains to this day. Obviously, it remains a varied region. There are lots of minority peoples, minority languages, minority religions. And while the Persians ultimately converted to Islam, they did not assimilate to the Arabs as some smaller peoples did. But this was an important package. It remains obviously influential in the world today. Change one. Change two. An Islamic religious zone was established gradually that ran from Morocco and Spain in the west all the way across the Middle East through India and on to Indonesia and even the southern Philippines in the east, a tremendous Islamic world that also spread south into Africa that also remains vibrant in the present day and